Violence rocks Memorial Day weekend in Miami. Credit cards for those without credit. And former Miami Heat star Chris Bosch. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There were multiple shootings across Miami this Memorial Day weekend. What do police know? We're going to get the latest and what the city is doing to make holidays safer. Also,
if you haven't lived in the U.S. for several years, or if you've never lived in the U.S., from a credit score perspective, you're basically starting from scratch.
It's hard for many immigrants to get credit. We're going to hear about a new program that could help people get a credit card without credit history. And finally, two-time NBA champion and former Miami Heat All-Star Chris Bosch shares life lessons in his new book, part one of our conversation with him. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. South Florida is dealing with the aftermath of multiple deadly shootings that happened over Memorial Day weekend. One of the shootings happened Sunday after midnight. Gunmen ambushed a crowd outside a concert in Northwest Miami-Dade, leaving two people dead and at least 20 others wounded. Police called it the worst mass shooting in Miami-Dade County's recent history. In total, there were 7 known instances of gun violence in the county since Thursday. Joining us now is Miami Herald Cops and Crimes reporter Chuck Rabin, who's been following the story. Chuck, I appreciate the time. Let's start with the Sunday morning shooting, Northwest Miami-Dade. Remind us briefly what happened there.
So there were a group of people in an area near the Clunchy Club of Miami, in this club that usually rents out space for music. And this white van, white SUV came by, strolled around the parking lot for a while. Three guys got out. There's video of it. They turn a corner, and in about 5 seconds, they unleash 100 rounds or more, strike 23 people, and 2 of them are dead at this point.
What role has social media played in this shooting and the police investigation?
Police think it has a lot to do with social media. They mentioned, and the director mentioned, that the beef started, or they believe it started over social media. We haven't been able to exactly nail down exactly what it was, but we have found accounts, of people threatening revenge and saying the streets are going to be bloody and all. But it's kind of an open forum, right? It's people commenting. So we don't really know the direct connections to who. It's been really tough trying to piece it together at this point.
And I mean, just a couple of days after, what do the police know so far? Do they have anything?
They know they found the car. It was a Nissan Pathfinder that someone had dumped in a canal over on 154 and 2nd Street. It was stolen from somewhere in the Northwest Dade section a couple of weeks ago. They have been speaking to victims. There are plenty of people who survived, remarkably. And they've been dealing, I believe, with some of the people who were inside. They're working on the possibility of it being linked to, the event, but they don't know for sure. They haven't said publicly. And those are the kinds of things that they're looking at.
There's a millionaire who's offered a $100,000 reward to anyone who provides information that could lead to the arrest. Who is this person? What's the connection to the story?
He's from down here. I'm not all that familiar with him, to be honest with you. I guess his name is Mark Lemonis. I'm not exactly even sure what his name is. He has a TV show, and he's apparently made lots of money, and he just has been sickened by the violence that's been going on down here. And he offered $100,000 for info leading to the arrest.
And police obviously asking anybody to come forward if they have information, but what protection can they offer from retaliation?
You can remain anonymous, obviously. They're not going to, the reward is being upped and upped and upped. Last I saw, it was like, not including the 100 grand, it was like at 30, but it's probably more than that now. Mm-hmm. Obviously you're going to be protected. There's different, nobody wants anyone to get harmed or to feel threatened. So you'll remain anonymous. It's not really a fear, but they desperately need people to come forward and tell them what they believe happened.
Again, talking with the Miami Herald's cops and crimes reporter Chuck Rabin about the multiple deadly shootings that happened over Memorial Day weekend in Miami-Dade County. In total, 4 people dead, more than 24 injured. Police department's asking people to come forward with any information. And you can follow these stories on our social media, WLRN Sundial. All right, so Chuck, unfortunately, the Sunday shooting, not the only one, as I mentioned. Late Monday night, there was another shooting in South Beach.
Well, not even close. It's been a really violent weekend down here. And, the fear initially was the beach, right? So they've had cops from different departments. There are about 100 county cops who actually worked the beach this weekend. And the first round of shootings, I mean, it started last Thursday. There was this crazy shootout that ended in Miami Hi-Li, where some guy's hanging out of a car, hits an innocent victim on the street and shoots 2 other people and hurts them, in a car that's being chased. Then on Friday, there was another event hall space in Wynwood where somebody came by and shot up in a crowd, killed a person and injured 6 others. Miami police are working that. They say they have some leads. They don't know exactly what it is. They're trying to see if it's somehow connected to the event the following night up in the North End, but they don't know if it is for sure. On Sunday, there was a shooting that left a couple of people, 1 shot in the arm and 1 in the leg near, on South Beach near Prime 112. There was another shooting in North Miami where a guy got shot in the chest and died. Another guy got shot in the leg. There was a Midtown shooting where it was a pure straight up robbery and the robber was shot dead. I heard there was another shooting this afternoon up in the North End. It's just been a really bad week.
And we don't know, or we don't think any of these are connected. They're all just separate.
The police don't seem to, they haven't seemed to come up with anything that says they are connected in any way at this point. They're desperately trying to look and see if that's the case, but nothing's firm and no one is, at least to us and through our sources and publicly, no one, we haven't heard anything about any of them being related.
So I've been here 7 years. I don't remember a Memorial Day weekend, anything like this. I mean, in your time here in South Florida, because you've been here a lot longer than I have you ever seen anything like this?
There have been bad mass shootings that have come one after the other, and I remember that. But the sheer numbers and geographically, how much it's spread out, like from the North End to Wynwood to Midtown to the beach to the absolute violence with these semi-automatic weapons. I mean, the fact that, these guys at the club up in the North End turned a corner on the video and were back at their car in 6 seconds and unleashed 100 rounds of gunfire, or more, is crazy. It's just people don't seem to care about collateral damage, and they're using really powerful weapons.
And have they been able to trace any of those weapons?
They haven't told us yet. There were different casings found in different situations, and the cops are kind of going a little crazy now too because they got so much on their hands.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned all this violence, and I mean, I was looking at this, murder rates in South Florida actually have been going down. The city of Miami saw its lowest murder rate in 50 years in 2020, but I mean, that's got to make this weekend really alarming.
I think it is alarming, but I think what's being, I think the numbers can always be skewed a little, because I think if you look at the homicide numbers in Miami-Dade and Miami, just for this year, that all around the country, major cities, the numbers have been up huge amounts, 30%, 40%, 50%. Miami's have been up significant, not anywhere near to those numbers, slight increases from previous years. But that part of that is how remarkable Jackson Memorial Hospital is. If you look at the actual non-fatal shootings, those numbers are up and much higher than they have been. That's the part. So the actual shootings are up.
Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava spent some time over the weekend promoting the Peace and Prosperity Plan to combat gun violence. They have money dedicated to law enforcement. The county is voting on this plan next month. But have they said anything about this weekend? Because I'm just wondering what they're saying about what this plan, what impact it could have on.
Well, it's not going to have an impact immediately, right? I mean, it's basically putting more money into, I think, a plan that started a little bit ago where you're trying to identify you know, at-risk kids and deal with them and mentor them and work with them and, you know, kids, definitely problem area kids. And it's doing a lot more community policing work. I think one of the issues that they're facing, at least I heard this when I spoke with them last year, was that, you know, the pre-COVID, you know, they had really picked up on community policing and they were going out and they were doing in the South End, they were doing stuff with kids and, you know, the police were working with them at parks and stuff like that. They cut back on a lot of that through COVID, just by necessity and because people weren't out as much. Whether they're, you know, they're going to try to get back up to those numbers. I don't think they're pre-COVID numbers yet. So I think that's one of the important things that they're looking at.
Yeah. And just wondering if all this violence, if that doesn't change the plan a little bit or maybe not, but
I know they're making it, you know, I mean, the mayor's been out front a couple of days now pushing it and speaking to the importance of it. And that, you know, I'm not really, Doug Hanks kind of covers the political aspect of that more than I do, but you know, she's pushing a project that matters to her and it's a good time for her to push it. So
yeah, definitely. He is Bybee Herald Cops and Crime Reporter Chuck Rabin. Again, follow his stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Chuck, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you, Lewis. Appreciate it, man.
Definitely. And you know, anyone with information on these shootings, please call Miami-Dade Crime Stoppers. I'll give you the number right now. It's 305-471-8477. Again, that's 305-471-8477. And as Chuck had mentioned, too, by the way, that you could be anonymous. All right. We changed tone a little bit here and moved to something else still to come. Many immigrants cannot get a credit card. A couple of major banks want to change that, and they were inspired by the George Floyd protests. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. More than 50 million Americans don't have a credit score. That means getting a car loan, a mortgage, or even trying to rent an apartment can be, well, incredibly challenging and expensive. The basics for building a credit score all start with a credit card. A new initiative from major banks like JP Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo beginning this year will allow individuals without credit scores to get access to credit cards. The initiative came from the Roundtable for Economic Access and Change. Following last summer's protest for racial justice, banks began looking at how minority populations lack access to credit. WLRN senior producer Chris Remington spoke with Wall Street Journal reporter Anna Maria Andriotis about the details of this plan.
For the millions of people across the country that don't currently have a credit score, what's the process for borrowing money on a small scale, like getting a credit card or a small loan from a bank?
In general, for people who don't have credit scores, getting approved for financing is very difficult. In some cases, can be impossible. That includes if they're trying to get a credit card, if they're trying to get personal loans, or if they're trying to get a mortgage. They can encounter many challenges, especially if they're trying to get that financing from banks. And that's because most banks in the U.S. for decades have required credit scores. So the general sort of underwriting process at most banks has been reviewing people's credit reports, which shows their history of how they've been managing their existing debts, as well as their credit scores, which are calculated off of the information in their credit report.
So help us understand this new proposed system. How would banks essentially determine how much money folks could get on a credit card, what their credit limit could be without a credit score?
Banks will be relying on the information within people's bank accounts to make these decisions. And so the idea here is that, okay, you know, there are some 53 million adults in the U.S. who don't have credit scores. That's according to FICO, which is the most popular credit score company in the U.S. And so the idea is, okay, there isn't enough information on these people in order for there to be a credit score. What else could we look at to determine whether they are financially responsible? Well, the bank account can show a lot of information information that would point to whether that financial responsibility exists. So things like, what are their account balances? Are they left over with money every month, or are they overdrawing? Of course, if they're overdrawing, that's a negative sign and a sign that maybe these people are too risky to get approved for credit. So the focus will be on looking at factors like this in people's bank accounts. Now, some banks, some large banks, like JP Morgan, like Bank of America, have been looking at bank accounts of their own existing clients, meaning that up until now, basically, if you went to one of these two banks, as an example, and applied for a credit card and you didn't have a credit score, they would look at, these banks do look at your bank account data if you have a bank account with those institutions. So for example, if you went to JP Morgan and you applied for a credit card, you didn't have a credit score, but you have a bank account with JP Morgan, the bank does look at the activity in that account and has made underwriting decisions, has approved people for credit based on that. But the blind spot for even banks like JP Morgan that have been using the strategy of, you know, reviewing bank accounts to approve people for credit cards, the big blind spot is what happens when a financial institution gets a credit card applicant who doesn't have a credit score, doesn't have much of a credit report, and doesn't have a bank account with that institution. In almost every case, that person's going to be rejected for credit. But if that bank could see that credit card applicant's bank account information at the bank where it exists, well, then that changes things.
Yeah, this is a really interesting novel idea in terms of banks sharing that type of in-depth information. I'm curious, if someone is unable to pay down the interest on their credit cards normally, their credit score is negatively impacted, but in this instance, these folks don't have credit scores. So what repercussions would customers face for poor financial behavior under this proposal?
The repercussions in many ways would be similar to the repercussions any consumer would face if they don't manage their debts well. So there is no guarantee here that, you know, you're approved for this card and, you know, off you go, your score improves, everything becomes better for you financially. I mean, this will require the cardholders, the borrowers, to be financially responsible. If you miss a payment on that credit card, that could very well hurt your credit score or keep you from establishing a good one. If you are carrying credit card debt from month to month and that debt is close to your overall card spending limit, that could also put you at a disadvantage from a credit score perspective. The goal here is to first identify people who are shut out of the financial system, of the lending system, because they don't have a score but are financially responsible, and to approve those people. And then really the responsibility largely falls on the consumers to handle that card well so that they can attain positive data on their credit report and therefore develop credit scores that are good.
So essentially under this program, the 53 million people that don't have credit scores aren't guaranteed to get a credit card. It just depends how financially responsible they've been with their checking account and with their other sort of financial instruments that they're using in their daily lives.
That's correct. There is no guarantee for these 53 million people that all of them are going to get approved. Certainly not. This is an attempt to identify people within this pool of 53 million adults in the US who deserve credit because they are financially responsible, but it's just not reflected in a credit score. So think of people like immigrants, people who are, you know, adults, they've come to the US, whether it's for career purposes or other reasons. And, you know, they could have been the most financially responsible person in the country from where they came. But when you come here, regardless of your age, if you haven't lived in the US for several years, or if you've never lived in the US, from a credit score perspective, you're basically starting from scratch. You don't have a credit score. but you have a bank account. That bank account should have some indicators in there, your account balance, that you're not spending more than you have in that bank account, that are signals to banks that you are a safe bet.
No, and I'm glad that you mentioned immigrants in particular, because immigrants from Latin America and the Caribbean make up such a large portion of the population here in South Florida, and having access to credit could have a fundamental impact on their lives.
Right. Let's start out with sort of the demographics. So a 2015 report by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau found that Hispanic adults and Black adults in the U.S. are more likely than white or Asian adults to lack credit scores. So there is a sort of social demographic element to the impact, like, and who is more heavily impacted by this versus others. The impact of not having a credit score is so far-reaching in someone's life. It's very difficult to get approved for a loan from a bank at a decent interest rate, so you're stuck in this corner of the market with very expensive loans. But beyond that, outside of credit, without a credit report, without a credit history in the U.S., even signing a lease in an apartment could be almost impossible. It could be very difficult. You know, landlords will ask for several months of payments, rent payments up front to compensate for the fact that you don't have a credit history in the U.S.
Interesting to note, or I should say important to note, we've talked about a lot of the positive benefits of having access to credit and credit cards, but there are also negatives. We had a conversation on our show a few weeks ago about the need to increase financial literacy so that way folks don't find themselves in a lot of credit card debt. And we heard from Sean in Lauderhill, a recent immigrant from Jamaica.
I got one of those bags from one of those credit card companies. It was a laundry bag. And that turned into a bag of financial troubles for me, to the point where I ended up filing bankruptcy. And if I learned how these financial instruments are to be used to your advantage, or how to use it in a new system.
So I'm curious if the banks have laid out a plan for financial education to these customers that aren't really familiar with the credit system and how credit cards work, so that way they don't dig a hole for themselves like what happened with Sean.
So the reason why this program is focused on giving credit cards as opposed to other loans is because credit cards, from a bank perspective, are viewed as the mainstream financing product that people can get themselves into, let's say, the least amount of trouble compared to others. Meaning that, you know, So when people get approved for these cards, it's not, the banks aren't looking at this as, we're going to approve these people, you know, for thousands of dollars of spending limits. So it is very likely that many of the people who will be approved will get their initial card will not have a high spending limit. If there is behavior on a credit card that suggests that this person might be getting in over their heads, banks will regularly review people's credit card accounts and their performance overall with other debts by reviewing their credit reports, and do take actions like lowering the spending limits on their cards as a way of pulling back and saying, well, you know, this person's carrying ever-growing balances. Let's limit their ability to carry more of them in case they can't handle the debt that everybody's taken on. There's no point in them digging themselves into a bigger hole. Now, to be completely, you know, transparent, of course, the strategy is also certainly meant to protect the banks, because the banks sort of view it as, if you're new to credit, it is way riskier to give you, for example, a personal loan where, you know, the $5,000 for, you know, of a personal loan is placed into your bank account, and then there's no control that the bank has over what happens and whether you pay that debt back. But with a credit card, the banks sort of view it from their end as limiting their potential exposure to losses if people don't pay this debt back.
And very briefly, I know this program was just recently proposed. Do we have a sense of how soon it could be implemented?
So the first bank that will start with this underwriting strategy will be JPMorgan Chase. And that is expected to start this year as soon as this fall.
That was the Wall Street Journal's Anna Maria Andriotis. You can read her story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I'm Sundial senior producer Chris Remington, and we're looking at how people traditionally shut out of the financial system are now getting connected. Let's turn and look specifically at South Florida's immigrant population. Alex Sanchez is the first Hispanic president and CEO of the Florida Bankers Association. Alex, welcome to the program.
Great to be on with you, Chris. Thank you.
Also joining us is Magnus Larson, CEO and president of Majority, a new mobile banking option for immigrants. They just opened an office here in Little Havana. Magnus, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alex, let's start with you. What do you see as the primary challenges in getting millions of immigrants living here in Florida into the traditional financial system?
Well, Chris, great topic. I think this is very important because banking the unbanked or the underbanked in our country is very important for the United States banking system, the strongest banking system in the world, the best capitalized, the highest capitalized banking system in the world. So consumers have a lot of choices they can make on where to bank for their personal needs. And look, as an immigrant myself to this great country, I saw my my two parents whose knowledge of English was very limited, if not at all. I mean, I don't think they even spoke English. And their English is still today very limited. I can tell you that I saw firsthand how my parents navigated as recent immigrants to this country when we arrived here years ago to start banking. And you know, it takes effort. I would ask people not to give up. Our banks today are much better equipped than they were when we came over as immigrants in the 1960s here to the United States. For instance, let me give you one example. There's Spanish-speaking bankers now. In Miami, my hometown of Miami, you virtually go to any branch. There's thousands of hundreds of bank branches of dozens of banks, and everyone there speaks Spanish or Creole or many other languages as well. So that's not an issue. One issue that, of course, is a societal issue is to get on an airplane, to open up a bank account, and to do many other things, you do need an ID. And that our banks are sometimes challenged with, because if you are a very, very recent and undocumented immigrant, then you may not have a government issued ID.
Alex, I want to jump into the identification issues in a moment. Sorry to jump in there, but do we have a sense of how large the unbanked population is in Florida and what banks are trying to do to get folks like your parents to get into the financial system?
Yes, I can tell you that, you know, on a national, I don't have the Florida numbers. We're talking about 6% of people in the United States are unbanked. So we're not talking about a big, big number. I mean, that's incredible, 6%. However, you know what? Let's make it 0%. And you know, saying 10%, 6%, sure, it's a low number, but I'd rather have zero.
And that's 6% is still millions of people when you're talking about a population.
Right, of 300 million plus people. So right. What I think people need to do is some people are afraid of banks. Some people are afraid that banks are going to report them to governmental agencies. And so depending on your status here in the United States as an immigrant, some of those may be a turnoff. But I encourage all immigrants that, look, the safest place that put your hard-earned money is not under the mattress in your apartment or your house. Put it in an FDIC-insured bank account where it's insured up to $250,000 per account. So, immigrants, you know, and all Americans, quite frankly, Chris, that's the best place to put. But specifically to immigrants, you know, banks are there to serve you. Language is no longer a barrier. Culture is not longer a barrier as it was for my parents. And imagine in New York in the 1960s, not knowing English, trying to go to a bank to open up an account. But it was possible then. It's even more possible now.
And there's a lot of different financial tools that are allowing that to be possible for immigrants. I want to bring you in, Magnus, because you're joining us from Sweden. Majority just set up an office here in Little Havana. First, give us a sense of what were some of the major differences you saw between the U.S. financial system and how it works in Europe and Latin America.
Well, I think to start off with, I the last 15 years I've been working with different immigrant communities, both here in Sweden, but also the last 7 years in the US. And previously I built a marketplace for migrants in the US to connect back home and provide services back home. And I think working with all the different communities around the US over the last years, I think it's very clear that the path and the journey that you have when you migrate, I migrate twice to the US. Right now I'm in a visa process to migrate back again to the US. There's a lot of these hurdles. And with working with most of these communities, when you travel and move to the other country, there's a lot of things. It's just not only banking. It's just calling back home to mom and tell you're alive. It's getting a job. It's getting a house. It's going into that bank account. And I think everyone that have migrated once in their life has gone through that journey where you suddenly, it's an overload of information. And if you even have that language barrier, I'm from Sweden, I speak fairly good English, and I'm from a rich country moving to the US, I still have, some of these, things are going through. And just understanding as a Swede the difference between a checking account, a savings account, a current account, etc. And those kind of nuances of the differences is something that I think is fundamental when you want to open a bank account. What we've seen and what we're doing, and we were the first, so to say, 2 years ago to start with our beta product in the market with a FDIC secured bank account to open that. What we learned from all the different communities is that there is still this cultural relevance of understanding, of feeling welcome also. That's why we opened our meetup space in Miami. We have opened one more in Texas. We're going to open them in more places in the US. It's being met from someone from your home country that can explain the differences. It doesn't mean that you're not available to get it. And I think a lot of things that we're meeting is that going into a Bank of America office or a Chase office, it's almost intimidating sometimes to go in. It's not because you are not allowed to be there. It's not allowed because you don't even have the documentation. It's just that it's easier to talk to someone that can understand your context. So what we've done with Majority is that we try to map that kind of journey. We try to take away a lot of all the crazy fees that is existing still in the market. And I think also the US banking system, when you look at it from a migrant perspective, is also not suited for the different aspects that you have. You have limits. First of all, you have overdrafts, which is a very specific US, item, which is crazy. You charge money for overdrafts and that without telling people, which is crazy. You have cost of checks. It's still a little bit of a manual. You have money orders to pay your rent because that's the only way that you can prove that you paid. There's so many very specific, unique items there that can be solved, I think, in the US system.
And I think another piece of Majority that's unique, you can jump in a moment, Alex. I was just going to say that it's also a mobile banking application that allows immigrants to send money back home, which obviously remittances are a huge part of the migrant population and the financial work they're doing here in South Florida.
Chris, I wanted to say though, Chris, look, and Magnus, thanks for your comments here. But one of the things I wanted to say is that, immigrants, there's a lot of low-frill, low-cost checking and savings accounts that immigrants can open up at a bank and in my hometown of Miami. So, a great majority, a high percentage of the bankers you'll find at any bank branch are either immigrants themselves or sons or grandchildren of immigrants. And so Miami is very hospitable and with open doors for people to come in to be received in the language that they're most comfortable with. And so that's not really an issue anymore. I think one of the concerns that I have is the shadow banking industry, Chris, that exists in this country that has tens, hundreds of billions of dollars who lure immigrants and other, and just Americans in general to do their financial services with them. And it ends up costing them more. They're not as regulated as an FDIC bank. So all your listeners, go to an FDIC bank. There are a lot of shadow banking industry so-called institutions out there, but there some of them are fly-by-nighters. You're guaranteed $250,000 up for each account for your, because, you know, immigrants work very hard. I know this firsthand, Chris, for my father and my mother. And the last thing my father and my mother wanted to do was to lose the few thousands of dollars that they had because of someone, got into our house or our apartment and stole it. Look, my parents bought that first home in Miami for $32,000 and saved $5,000 as a down payment in 1973. And I remember the day in the Sanchez family, Chris, and that was possible then. And it's even more possible now when that FDIC banker called my father, my mother, and told them their bank loan was approved to buy our first home in America. That was a big day. And guess what? That happens every day in this country through the service of FDIC banks to Americans and to immigrants as well.
Again, we are the voice that you're hearing there is Alex Sanchez. He's the president of the Florida Bankers Association. Also with us is Magnus Larson, CEO and president of Majority. This is a new mobile banking opportunity for immigrants in Miami. And we're discussing how banks are expanding access to immigrant populations in Florida. Again, you can learn more about a plan for major banks to give credit cards to those without credit scores by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. So interesting, something both of you are talking about here, the complexities and concerns of our banking system and how much education that immigrants might receive to learn about it. Magnus, I'll start with you in terms about the information campaign to teach immigrants about how banking works and what that process looks like.
Well, we has one fundament of our product actually is a content area. We call it the community space in our product, where we basically share all what we see is the relevant information that you need, you know, not only in terms of banking, but it can be about getting a visa, et cetera, all about that whole full journey. I think one of the more interesting as well, because I think even if we're mentioning here that it's easy to go into a bank, we still have huge areas in Hialeah and around where you have the different kiosks or the mercados and the food stores where you go today to send money, where you're paying extremely high fees today.
That's correct.
And that is still so to say a fact. So it's the banking and also the banking system itself is charging all of those extra fees that are, I think sometimes is not with purpose, I think, from the bigger banks being charged. And those some example is also you have these higher limits. And I think those are specifics to very, you know, when you're not in, when you're an immigrant, that you don't need those. And that's why we package, so say, all our product into a subscription model where we're basically giving away all of those basic services at cost or free instead of charging that, because it's an understandable way of actually consuming these services. And I think partially in going back to your question is partially of, you know, educating, I think everyone is about giving everyone the opportunity to thrive and succeed by also not overcharging them for things they don't know they need to pay for. And I think that is a little bit on how we've been thinking about how to build our, you know, our product as well. And I think some of the things, if you listen to that interview that we just listened before us also, it's like technology is happening. When we started our 2 years ago, when we started our digital bank, there were not even another, we were the first digital banks focusing on immigrants in the US. Seven of them have launched, as I know of, since then. Credit score to import, we have Nova Credit from New York that's doing a great job where you can import your actually credit score from your home country. So there is a lot of technology companies right now coming into this space just to help and ease and smoothen this journey, because the whole society just, you know, if we can just make this process faster, we're just going to get more prosperity. And I think that is one of the, you know, the major challenges that we're tackling also, and all of us that's focusing on it.
And Alex, I want to turn to you and specifically this issue of equity. What was really interesting to me from this previous conversation we heard about offering credit cards to those without credit scores. This came out of the Roundtable for Economic Access and Change following the racial justice protests last summer. And the group is essentially looking at ways that minority communities often lack access to traditional financing. So I'm curious for you, among Florida bankers, among managers of banks that you've spoken to, what self-reflection has occurred over the past year that's led to concrete changes to try and increase credit to folks that don't normally access it?
You know, Chris, look, our banks, in again, we're talking, we're in Florida, and we're talking Florida, right? Well, you know, Florida is so ahead of where the rest of the country has been on this particular issue. Where Florida is has been a state of incredible numbers of immigrants who continue to flow into our shores day in and day out. People like Magnus. People from the hemisphere. Miami, of course, has been touted ever since President Clinton did hosted the summit of the Americas in Miami as really the capital of the hemisphere. So, you know, in Florida, we have dealt not just in Miami, but in Tampa, Orlando, where there's great immigrant groups as well. Our banks have been dealing with immigrants for decades now. So we're not in the position of something perhaps some other states in our great nation who are now dealing with immigrants or providing credit and access to the banking system to those for the first time. We've been doing that for a long time. And I got to tell you, Chris, we're good at it. In Florida, I think that if you immigrants here in our state have had access to the banking system, continue to have access. You know, when I go back home to Miami, I see recent immigrants who have bought homes, who have jobs, who only just a few short years ago arrived in our shores. So, you know,
Alex, if I could push back here for a moment, though, if you look at the data historically, minority populations are turned down for home loans and car loans at much higher rates than their white counterparts. And that data plays out not just across the United States, but in Florida as well. So I'm asking for the Florida Bankers Association as an organization, has there been some introspection over the past year about issues related to who can access credit based on race and gender and socioeconomic backgrounds?
Yeah, and my response to that is that's always been a priority for us and continues to be a priority for us. It's, again, living in the state of Florida where access to credit by immigrants has always been a top priority in this marketplace. You cannot be a banker in Florida and not see the reality of what's happening in our streets, in our cities each and every day by the influence of immigrants to this great state. I mean, I don't know any banker who doesn't see that reality day to day. Banking people for the first time, the unbanked, has always been, Chris, and continues to be the priority for our bankers. And now, again, I'm talking about Florida, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's the state I'm in. I'm the CEO of the Florida Bankers Association. I meet with our bankers all the time, from coast to coast, North Florida, South Florida, and in between. That is a priority because we're Florida. Look at our state. Look at our makeup. We've had immigrant populations that have an incredible economic impact to our state, to our real estate, to our retail, to our everyday life. So that's always been, what I'm offering to you is that has always been a top priority for Florida bankers.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it there. It's a fascinating conversation that we could go at least an hour on. Again, Alex Sanchez, president of the Florida Bankers Association. Also, Magnus Larson, the CEO and president of Majority, a new mobile banking application that opened an office here in Little Havana. Alex and Magnus, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris, for having us.
And still to come, former NBA champion and Miami Heat star Chris Bosh out with a new book, Luis Hernandez, with part one of that conversation.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Miami Heat have been knocked out from the first round of the NBA playoffs, getting swept by the Milwaukee Bucks this past weekend. It was a painful loss to watch for former Miami Heat star Chris Bosh, but he's seen his team overcome adversity in the past. Bosh was part of the Miami Heat's Big Three with LeBron James and Dwayne Wade, the team that was defeated by the Dallas Mavericks in the NBA Finals a decade ago. That same team would go on to win the championship the following year. Now, Bosch details this story and many more in his new book, Letters to a Young Athlete. It's available in bookstores and online today. Bosch has a virtual event with Dwayne Wade and Books and Books tonight. We have more information about how you can sign up on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Here's a piece of that conversation. You'll have to tune in tomorrow to hear the full interview. Chris, I love that you start the book with a letter from Pat Riley, and he's looking at some of the greatest challenges and victories of your career. How do you describe who Riley is in your life and how he changed you as a player and a person?
I mean, he's been a mentor. That would be the best way to describe it. He's been a mentor, acting president of the Heat, and, you know, he was pretty much the authority figure for a while in my years with the Heat. But, you know, we've had many conversations about basketball, about getting the best out of yourself, about life, you know, about dealing with loss, about not playing anymore. And he's just always been so insightful. And, you know, he's one of those guys where, you know, a conversation always helps because he cares. And, you know, through everything that we've gone through, he has always just been, you know, solid. You know, he's always had, you know, that open door policy where you can, you know, even if you're, you know, a player, which I did many times, just go up and talk to him and, you know, have a conversation. Mm. And, you know, he's always had that. So, you know, he's always fit that mentor role. And I mean, you know, my dad thought Pat Riley was cool. He was like, you know, that's Pat Riley, man. You know, I'm trying to get him to be serious, you know, in the meetings, you know, we're free agency meetings. He's like, he's starstruck, you know? So he just represented that, you know, that figure that, you know, is just like, a mentor and somebody that just helps you out and says, gives you that right piece of advice.
Yeah. I think about, you know, the one thing that was, I was dying to ask you about, you mentioned in the book, and this is a coach going back to your youth, and you'd mentioned like you were practicing one day and the coach stops you and then says, what are you doing with this? And yeah. you thought he was talking about basketball, but he actually was asking you this deeper question about your life. And I was wondering, what was that moment? And, you know, did you understand what he was asking you?
I did not. It took me a while to understand it. And I mean, even then I got a level of it, but you know, those were one of the things I remember. Cause you know, for me, I just love being in the gym. It was nothing more I loved than playing basketball. In that particular instance, you know, it was pretty hardcore. We were like working out at night on a school night, you know? So like, we're in the gym late and we're getting work in and like he was looking at me like he hadn't seen me in a while, you know, and we were working out and he was just the look in his eyes like, man, what is he looking at? You know, and I told him, yeah, I want to go to college and stuff like that. He's like, yeah, that's easy. You're going to go to college, man. You need to start, you know, just preparing your mind. You can play at the next level, you know, that's not even what we're talking about, you know? So he wanted me to kind of think about those things that'll keep my head on straight, you know? And I remember him coming to my high school team, and he was talking about friendship and you know, having teammates and do you know your teammate's name? You know, do you know their brothers and sisters? You know, things to think about as a team. So like, you know, he was already that big brother figure that had, you know, he taught me the game pretty early, but then he saw my transformation. And so in that, yeah, he said, yeah. And that's when I knew like, okay, I think I can go to the NBA. I'm pretty sure I can go to the NBA because I'm looking at this guy and I'm looking at his face. And yeah, and we're not talking about, you know, going D1 or anything like that. We're talking about, I don't know what we're talking about. We're talking about something else, but it took me a while to kind of reflect on that and think about that.
That is former Miami Heat All-Star Chris Bosch. His virtual event with Books and Books happening tonight at 7 p.m. You can find more details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And by the way, tune in tomorrow to this program and hear the rest of that interview. He talks about, not just Coach Riley, but he talks about, what's the hunger that drives him now? You know, he doesn't have basketball in his life anymore, but what's driving him? What's the next big thing for Chris Bosh? All of that coming up in the program tomorrow. And that's our show for this Tuesday, June 1st. Tomorrow on the program, it's the start of a new hurricane season. Starting today, we're going to hear from the director of the National Hurricane Center about new technology available to forecast storms and how to deal with storms that rapidly intensify. And this, of course, is a great chance for me to remind you, start preparing now. If we learned anything from COVID, go start buying your supplies now, stack them up so we're not all buying everything and buying all the gas 2-3 days before a storm. Let's do it now. Start preparing. By the way, on our website, WLRN.org, there is a list of everything you need to prepare for a hurricane, if in case this is new for you. By the way, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we are reading The Key Lime Crime by Lucy Burdett. Head to Facebook now and search Sundial Book Club and ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. Tell us if you've been reading the book. Give us an update. What do you think about it so far? We're going to be talking with the author pretty soon. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. Remember, the program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.